This podcast edition of The Culture Show was first aired on the 21st of November 2011 for Monocle 24 here in London. The Culture Show, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and thanks for tuning in to show 6 of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're exploring the creative impulse, asking if life imitates art or just steals her best dresses, and adjusting the needle on our moral compass as we explore truth and fiction in books, films and paintings. We ask artist Dexter Durward what he makes of art's attempts to portray the truth.
I still think it's a very interesting thing to stand in front of a painted image and to have thoughts and feelings about things and about the world. Because the lie is, you know, painting is a phenomenal visual lie.
We're also joined in the studio by film director Simon Curtis to talk about blurring boundaries between truth and fiction in films as we dissect his new movie, My Week with Marilyn. And novelist Alex Preston is here. His Bleeding City was a debut novel that drew on his experience as a city trader. Where does memoir end and fiction begin? Hopefully, he can tell us.
I think maybe it's that life is so complex that it's so difficult to get a hook on even an idea of the truth, that both the audience and the artist need a way of finding an authority in truth.
Plus, from Adelaide, we take a look under and behind the covers of the excellent Collect magazine, a local piece of publishing that makes for fascinating fodder wherever in the world you read it.
You'd never do something if you weren't a little bit naive, if you actually knew what was involved and the financial costs and, you know, the heartache, the sweat. You wouldn't do it, but because you don't know, I think that's what excites people to do something new.
We also explore the fledgling world of digital art and its online gallery. Harry Blaine and Matt Collishaw tell us why tablets and TVs can be canvases too. And we move to Hong Kong for our opening night at the Blind Spot Gallery. And Travis Elbra, last week's vinyl guru, takes our little recorder out to make a landmark 1 minute of sound. Welcome to the 6th edition of Culture here on Monocle 24, a show boasting an embarrassment of cultural riches aimed at exploring this week's theme, truth and fiction. Chief amongst those riches are my two studio guests, film director Simon Curtis and novelist Alex Preston. But first, to keep things thematic, and because it's completely charming, here's Ella Fitzgerald singing I'm Always True to You in My Way.
If a custom tailored vet asks me out for something wet, when the vet begins to pet, I cry hooray. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way.
That was Ella Fitzgerald. Now, today we're discussing the theme truth and fiction, just a small topic. And I'm joined in the studio by Simon Curtis, director of My Week with Marilyn, out this week, which is a film of the filming of a film. Sort the truth from the fiction in that. And I'm also joined by Alex Preston, author of This Bleeding City and the upcoming The Revelations. Thank you for coming in, both.
Good morning.
Simon, I wanted to start with you. As I said in the intro, My Week with Marilyn is the film of the filming of a film. There are lots of layers of performance in it. Norma Jean struggling to become Marilyn Monroe sometimes in order to be on set and be able to act herself as the showgirl in The Prince and the Showgirl. Was this a sort of complicated and complex kind of web to start off with?
Well, you're right. There are lots of layers in the film, but principally we are filming the memoir of a young man in 1956. So Colin Clark, who was the third assistant director on The Prince and the Showgirl, which was filmed in Pinewood in 1956, published later in life his memoirs of what was an extraordinary first job. So really, we were telling Colin's version of these events.
And there's three sort of dynamics in the film, just to flesh out our listeners, who I'm sure will obviously go and see the movie, but it's the sort of dynamic between Marilyn Monroe, the big Hollywood star, coming over to the UK, to Pinewood, to star as the showgirl in Sir Laurence Olivier's version of The Prince and the Showgirl. And there's a dynamic between the old school Shakespearean actor, the Knight of the Realm, and this kind of 30-year-old kind of bombshell who's come from Hollywood. And it's the sort of interacting, it's the collision between those two worlds as well.
Very much so. It's 1956, and in some ways, Olivier, now 50, is emblematic of fading Britain in the years after the war. And Marilyn, age 30, is emblematic of complicated, new, exciting America. And the two of them, Olivier with his theatre-based external acting style, was very much in conflict with Marilyn, now obsessed with Strasberg and the method and interior psychological acting. So they were two actors divided by a common theatrical language, if you like.
How much interest did you have in how real it was and how truthful to real events it was, or even to Colin Clark's memoir?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I would say very, very interested, because, you know, I felt there were so many different versions potentially of what happened when they made this film. There'd be as many different versions of people who were on the set. And our version was Colin's version, if that makes sense. And he describes it in the introduction to one of his memoirs as a fairy tale that nevertheless was real. And, you know, our objective was to tell his version that felt authentic with a sort of magical realism element in as well.
And we're talking about versions of the truth. Alex, I wanted to start off by asking you about your debut novel out a couple of years ago, This Bleeding City, which lots of people mistook for a sort of semi-autobiographical first novel. You used to be a trader in the city, and it's about a young man that has trouble and strife in the city and has a sort of moral fallout because of it. In terms of versions of the truth, how easy is it when you're writing, especially your first book, to keep your own truth out of it, your own story?
Well, I always took that as something of a compliment when people saw it as autobiographical, semi-autobiographical, because what I really wanted to do, it was written just as the credit crunch was happening, and I saw this story and felt there was a kind of moral imperative to talk about what went on, to talk about what went on specifically for my generation, for people who had perhaps in former lives would have gone into journalism or civil service, done something else, but because of the ridiculous riches involved in the city, because we were all perhaps a little bit naive and starry-eyed and thought, oh, we'll go and, you know, my thing was I'll go and do this for a couple of years and then go rent a house somewhere in the south of France and write my Ulysses. But of course, none of us did that. And I wanted to tell the story of that generation. So I spent a long time speaking to friends, speaking to contacts within the city and trying to tell their story. It was very much trying to tell something, I think, broader and in some ways more truthful than my own slightly sad and pathetic self story.
And people are very interested in the idea of the truth, though. People want to find the truth in literature. People want to find the truth in films. And these, you know, a fictional portrayal of someone that's similar, perhaps, to the person that wrote it, and a film about, you know, events that happened in real life. These are a big hook in terms of publicity and in terms of, you know, people feel they have an ownership of the subject matter already. How important is that?
It does feel, if you look at modern culture at the moment, there is a sort of crisis in fiction. Yeah. That I don't know if it's a reality TV age, but you think of the two big films last year, for example, The King's Speech and Social Network, were both...
Well, and 127 Hours.
Completely.
And The Fight. You know,
completely.
It was
completely
an
right.
age of reality yeah. hunger, isn't it? It's extraordinary.
Completely. And that somehow people almost don't want to take the risk of fiction or something, or maybe we've run out of stories or something.
Perhaps it's that the audience, you know, that weird stamp from a true life story, which, you know, with all due respect, with a man in the room who's made from a true life story. But it's true that people want these real life stories. People want, I think maybe it's that life is so complex that it's so difficult to get a hook on even an idea of the truth, that the both the audience and the artist need a way of finding an authority in truth.
Well, let me ask you then, Simon, how responsible do you have to be to that truth? Obviously, you said it's a dramatization of Colin Clark's memoir, so you've obviously got the middleman there already. But I mean, how responsible do you have to be to the truth of his book?
Well, all I can say is you do your best. You know, yeah. I mean, a wise person once said about filmmaking that there's the script version of a film, there's the shoot version of the film, and there's the editing version of the film. And if it's based on a book, before those three, there's the source book version of a film. You know, and things inevitably evolve. You know, on the day you don't quite get that scene, or that line isn't delivered as well as you hoped, and so on. But all I can say is, you know, we did our best to tell the truth, and there was so much sort of photographic evidence of Marilyn's time in London. So, you know, our starting point was to be as authentic as possible. But obviously there's a process you go through, you know, and you know, no one actually knows. But
And you must become aware over the process of the filming that what you are doing even there is portraying some sort of fiction. And I think it must be particularly the case with somebody like Marilyn, about whom even the truth of her has become mythographized or mythologized.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, and actually, you know, we talked very early on about how in our film there were three Marilyns. Mm-hmm. There was the Marilyn playing Elsie in The Prince and the Showgirl, for which we had all the evidence because there was the film we could consult. There was Marilyn, the public Marilyn, if you like, the Marilyn of press conferences and walking off the plane and the paparazzi, which we had quite a lot of evidence for. And then the private Marilyn, where we didn't have any evidence except for Colin Clark's account of those private scenes. So, you know, each of those different realities of Marilyn, we had different sources for. Do you know what I mean?
We went off and saw Dexter Dalwood, who's the Turner-nominated British artist, who paints scenes that exist in popular consciousness, that they've been mythologised and made famous by news reports. He painted Brian James's swimming pool, the Liberace Museum, which is Liberace's house, the Queen's bedroom. And last year he was nominated for the Turner Prize for, amongst other works, The Death of Dr. David Kelly. David Kelly being the government scientist who committed suicide after the supposed dodgy dossier was found out and the 45-minute claim to go to war in Iraq was discovered. And this is what I spoke to him about when we met last week. I wondered, talking about truth and fiction, whether your work and painting as a medium is interested in truth. Can it ever be truthful? Is it necessarily more interpretative than a photograph?
It's not real, as in the sense that all art is fiction, obviously, but I think it's the sense of the displacement between a sort of slowing down and thinking of projecting yourself into the idea of the space, you know. So the way you negotiate them is you sort of have to go a bit with that, and hopefully it stops being consumed in a nanosecond. Do you know what I mean? Because I think the problem is that lots of stuff, you look at it, you think, oh yeah, I got it. You know, and you can move on. And if something stops you and you have to sort of negotiate it and think how it's done against what it's depicting against, you know, the history of how things have been depicted. And it makes you, you know, if that process starts you thinking, that's art, just for me, because that's what art does well, is it makes you keep thinking about it, even if the reaction is, like, oh, I hate it. I still think it's a very interesting thing to stand in front of a painted image and to have thoughts and feelings about things and about the world and the experience of art through, you know, all these people making things on surfaces before. Because the lie is, you know, painting is a phenomenal visual lie.
I think there we've got a quote, right? Are you interested in the truth? Is your painting interested in the truth?
I'm interested in the sense that a painting has to justify itself here and now. Do you know what I mean? And the truth is a very difficult word, I think, to use about any art in that way. You know, it's a bit like Quentin Tarantino's film, you know, Inglourious Basterds, which, for me, the press it received, unbelievable. People just thought it was like a bad war movie. I thought it was incredibly intelligent, sophisticated idea of thinking about a period of time, thinking about the history of violence in expressing that through the medium of cinema, thinking about appropriation, thinking about how you could bring all those things together and make a genre movie, but twist it so it uses all these different references. And I just think it was like, talk about sophisticated. You had to, you know, it was deeply embedded subjective appropriation.
Yeah. Your work seems to be political in a sense. It's about people and about people's perception of an idea, a moment in history and the rest of it. When you switch on the news and open your newspaper in the morning, I mean, like, is it always fertile ground? Are you always wondering, like, why this photograph has been constructed like this, why they've chosen this picture to be put next to this story? I mean, not in a laboured way, but are you always aware of this idea, the manipulation of the image in what purports to be, you know, the news and the truth and this?
A bit, yeah. I mean, I meant that when I saw lots of pictures of Gaddafi, there was one picture where behind him was this textile. And the textile actually was very similar to a Matisse painting. So yeah. Immediately I'm looking at that, thinking, God, it's amazing that sort of he's got this sort of reclining figure, dead Gaddafi, against this textile. Not unlike, you know, making me think. So in that way, it's that thing of seeing it as image, do you know what I mean? Purely as image. I wasn't seeing it as news report in the sense, but I wasn't seeing it as image. And then I started to think, that's interesting, you know, that's an interesting pattern to use with the idea of, you know, death in some ways. So I suppose that there's that, you know, but it wasn't, it's also not prurient, you know what I mean? I'm not interested in kind of doing it as it happens. I suppose for me, it has to go through a period of thinking about it. And I'm not interested in any sort of tub thumping, and I don't like political art.
No.
When I see it as political art, what do I mean? I mean, it's the reason I like Picasso over Matisse in a way, because Picasso is sex, death, politics, and Matisse is sort of sex, beauty, you know. So it's different. And I do like that underlying, I like a bit of blood on the carpet. You know, that's what I'm sort of looking for in a way.
That was me speaking to Dexter Dalwood about his version of Truth and Fiction a little earlier. And for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, where we're discussing Truth and Fiction. And I'm joined in the studio by Simon Curtis, director of My Week with Marilyn, and Alex Preston, author of This Bleeding City. When you're searching for the truth in fiction, in the fiction that you both make, how much blood on the carpet does there need to be? How much nitty gritty in reality does there be? How much, you know, defiance in the face of beauty?
Well, I mean, you know, this is the thing that the idea that if you're representing history, if you're, I mean, I thought that was interesting, his reference to Inglourious Basterds, which I thought, like him, I thought was a very, very interesting film. And I thought did do something about how we appropriate the past, how we appropriate the kind of more painful elements of the past. And I actually, just thinking while I was listening to that about something we were talking about earlier, this idea that we are reaching a crisis of what a film can do, of what a book can do, of how we use that architecture of the traditional Hollywood film or the traditional realist novel, and how somehow I think we have begun to feel that there's something sham in the conventions of the form. So, you know, the man walks into the room and there's something going on in the corner and he notices it. And, you know, this kind of very conventional way
of
telling...
You mean in novels? Or you mean
I mean in novels, or I think in a film, you know, the way that we have become so used to a film playing out in a particular way that we cannot but help but feel like frauds while we're doing this. And I think that's really what Dexter Dalwood was getting at there. I think that there's this idea that history and life is now so degraded by what has happened over the past 100 years that you know, the idea of representing the truth has become such a painfully urgent but also such a difficult thing that we actually need to say, well, what I'm doing is presenting history. What I'm not doing is presenting some fictionalized appropriation of a story from the past. What I'm doing is giving you it as it is.
And Dexter also mentioned the word prurience, and it's that idea of when you're searching for the truth, if fiction is searching for the truth, whether it's movies, whether it's novels, whether it's painting, the idea of knowing the life of the artist, not in necessarily a prurient way, but we always feel that that's quite important. Having made a film that's, you know, that's got many layers of reality to it and is written from a memoir, how important is the life of Laurence Olivier in his private life? Vivien Leigh runs in and out of shots, you know, quite a lot of times in the movie.
It seemed to me when we were making the film that, you know, because it was, we were trying to recreate a moment in time. It wasn't a biopic. It wasn't a whole life. It was an episode that hopefully would shine light on a whole life, that, you know, we did as much research as we could about where each of our protagonists were in their lives at that point. And it was obviously a big turning point, actually, in many of their lives. But just listening to the discussion, I was thinking how Marilyn, as ever, was a sort of prototype for so many of these things. Because now, with so many of the celebrities and movie stars in our popular culture, We are sometimes as interested in their private lives as their work, and in many cases, much more interested in their private lives than their work. And that she was like so far ahead of her time, where obviously there were her performances, but there was also the ongoing soap opera of her life, her marriages, her affairs, and of course her tragic death and the mystery surrounding that.
I think that actually it's a fine line to tread. Of course, the audience want that slightly salacious detail, and that is, I guess, what partly made Marilyn famous. But they also want the truth of everything outside it. And I think if people do just focus in on these seamy issues, then you do lose something more universal.
Well, it becomes sort of metafiction, doesn't it? It becomes if you make a film about two film stars not getting on, but her, you know, getting on with the third assistant director. You want to know about their relationship in real life. You write a novel, people want to know what. If you're a banker and you write a novel with a banker in it, then people want to know how real that is. Does that help in any way in understanding the fiction? This is something we always come down to. Knowing Simon Curtis's private life or Alex Preston's private life or the private life of the film stars who star in your movies, does that in any way aid understanding of the larger fictional concept?
I suppose for me, in the case of our film, which is much in my mind at the moment, the idea that this was a hidden true story, a story that is in the public domain, is published, but not everyone knows about, makes it a more interesting proposition for people. Do you mean that?
And you have elevated it. And that's what I think is really interesting about the film, is that this now becomes, moves up the pecking order in that mythography of Marilyn. It's a constantly changing thing. And I think that's so fascinating about these myths, that you immediately you contribute to it, then you are changing the priorities of how people view things.
And it's also interesting because, going around to film festivals and meeting audiences, for many people, Marilyn is a very famous name and an even more famous face. They don't necessarily know much about her life and certainly don't necessarily know much about her performances. And I was thinking, hearing Dexter talk, thinking of really the most famous lasting image of Marilyn is a Warhol image. Mm-hmm. And effectively, that's doing a lot of the things we're talking about. It's taking a photograph and making it art by colouring it or shading it in certain ways. And, so taking the reality and making it something else, something, a piece of art based on a real face.
We like to think, and I don't know whether we still think, that one of the responsibilities of fiction is to tell us truths that we sort of felt but we didn't know. Is that something that's being eroded, people's belief in fiction's ability to teach us truths, do you think?
One of the things I was thinking when I was setting out to write This Bleeding City was that people didn't understand what was going on in the financial world, and that the structure of a novel is a very useful way for people to find their way into truths. I believe, whilst yes, we have a reality hunger, yes, we are reaching crisis in fiction, I do believe that the traditional novel and perhaps the traditional film are still the best ways of finding your way into a story.
And in terms of that, is it easier to work from a memoir than it is to write a fresh script and have a fresh idea about the life of Marilyn Monroe, and especially how she rubbed up to other people?
I don't know, but I'm not a writer, but I look for writers to tell me something about the world I haven't already thought of. And when I see great writing, it's the most exciting thing possible. Do you know what I mean? But in the absence of that great writing, real stories are incredibly important as well, but nothing, for me, nothing would beat great writing that takes your breath away.
Well, thank you very much, Simon Curtis, director of My Week with Marilyn, and Alex Preston, author of This Bleeding City and the upcoming The Revelations. Thank you very much for
joining us. Thank you very much.
Both. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band. We're back with some music after this.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing,
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world, in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson & Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
Welcome back to Culture here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds. Now here's a man who knows a thing or two about pretending to be someone else. David Bowie, Gene Genie. I'm Gene Genie, lives on his back. The Gene Genie loves in the stacks. He's out Jesus, he screams at you balls. The Gene Genie, let yourself go. That was Gene Genie, David Bowie from Aladdin Sane. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Coming up in part two of Culture, we hear from gallerist Harry Blaine and artist Matt Collishaw about a new online digital art gallery. They'll tell you what that means. We rock up for a flute of fizz at a gallery opening in Hong Kong and get experimental with our 1 minute of sound. All that. Plus, we visit the peeps behind the excellent Collect magazine in Adelaide. Stay tuned. Small is beautiful. That's the message we're getting from this modern interconnected world. You don't live in cities anymore, it's your neighbourhood that counts. And why not tell the world about it? That's what a small independent Australian magazine is doing, and after just a year in print, its entrepreneurial young editors have surprised themselves with the interest they're getting from across the globe. The magazine, Collect Mag, comes out of the small city of Adelaide in South Australia. We sent resident Annie Hastwell to meet its founders, Josh Fanning, Farron Foster and Adam Johnson, on the balcony of their inner city office.
We're overlooking Rundle Street, which is essentially the fashion sort of precinct of Adelaide. It's on weekends and after hours it becomes the restaurant and fashion area, but during the week it's a really nice little village.
Adam Johnson is Collect Mag's designer.
Did you want to come and have a squeeze at the office?
Love to.
He and editor Josh Fanning and journalist Farron Foster put the magazine together here in their first floor office above the boutiques and cafes of Adelaide's East End.
A cup of tea?
Yes, please.
The space was pretty cruddy when we first got it. We did quite a lot of work. It's cozy now.
It's really nice.
It's not massive, but it's quaint. We like it.
The three are young, creative, and ambitious enough to launch an international magazine, but without feeling the need to move from where they're comfortable, their own hometown and their own neighbourhood.
In my particular field, the creative field, it's one of those things that's the first thing people do. They establish themselves, get to a certain level of seniority in their chosen craft, and then they scurry off to the bigger cities. And I'm a big believer that creativity can come from anywhere. And I think in this day and age, you know, the connectivity of good ideas is so easy. You don't need to be in the core of it. You don't need to be in New York or San Francisco or London.
Sitting in Adelaide, you find wonderful people and amazing things, and I think that's what made us want to do the magazine. We all know about great things and we wanted to share that with people.
It's really what defines you. I think increasingly you as a person, you as a citizen, will be defined by the company you keep and the choices you make in your day-to-day. And the local is something that the internet can't at least imitate. It's all we've got left is this real touch and feel and taste and smell. And that's what the magazine's about.
Well, let's look at the magazine. It is bite-sized indeed. It's probably about a quarter the size of a normal magazine.
Half a size. A5 is generally half an A4, and A4 is pretty much what newsstands around the world are built for. So we definitely disappear if we're on a mainstream newsstand. So that's essentially why we don't distribute largely through mainstream avenues. We handpick our stockists.
And the edition we're looking at, the issue we're looking at, has a trowel on the front.
Maybe AJ can decide why we put a hand trowel on the cover.
Well, all of our covers to date have had an iconic thing on the front. And the first issue was a watch, and the second issue was a microphone. We'd find something iconic that's existed for a long time and hasn't changed. And this was Cyclone, who are an Australian manufacturer of garden products, and they designed and built this product, you know, a very long time ago, and it hasn't changed. And I think that's a big part of what the magazine is about, is things that are built to last.
The search for thoroughly authentic local products worthy of Collect Mag's front page turned up another Adelaide gem, the long-established Rossi Boot Factory.
They make shoes, and they make them with a lifetime guarantee, and for us that's jackpot, you know, like that's the sort of company that we want to work with. So they didn't have the appropriate ad copy for us, so we made it ourselves. And I think that's kind of a bit pretentious, but it's also, they called us in 2 weeks later and they said, well, here's your ad. We've blown it up to A2 poster. We've hung it on our wall. It's the first, well, it's the only communication we've sort of done in 100 years where we've been able to measure how much influence it's had on the market. We've just been taking phone calls and emails, and it's amazing.
I'm getting a picture of a magazine run on some pretty firm principles here. Advertising the authentic, celebrating the local, but hoping to engage the world. So what kind of stories do they run?
Last issue we went up to the Flinders Ranges, which is this amazing part of Australia, which is should be really iconic, but I'm not sure that the rest of the world knows about it. It's full of geology, which is older than any other place in the rest of the world, and full of plants and wildlife that shouldn't be able to survive because there's no water and no food out there, but they somehow do. And everybody lives 4 hours away from each other but still knows each other like they're next door neighbours. And up there, there's a bit of a struggle at the moment because the geology being so old means it contains a lot of uranium, which obviously is worth a lot of money. So there's a bit of a balance to be looked at between it's whether it's worth destroying the history of the world, basically, in order to get that money out of the ground.
When you decide what to write about and where to go, and you obviously have a great commitment to what's local and around you in Adelaide and South Australia, but are you thinking also about an international audience?
I think the thing about the stories that we tell is it's the context of them is very important, but it's not specific to a particular audience. I think the things that we talk about, they're universal stories that are told in a local place.
We set out to make Collect for Adelaide, but without the limitations of just being about South Australia or being about Adelaide. We wanted to show like-minded people in Adelaide the world and show them that Adelaide is a part of that world. And that's important. But 3 issues in, we get a call from probably the best or the biggest magazine, a specialty store in Australia, Mag Nation, and they want to stock our magazine. So all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, really? You know it's about Adelaide, right? How are you going to sell it? And they're like, no, it's a great mag. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what it's about. It's a good magazine.
And they put it on their counter.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been spiraling since that stage. And, I mean, I sent them to Stockholm. And they sell them in a beautiful little store called Papercut. And they love it. And they said, yeah, we'll support it. It's a great magazine. And same with Hong Kong. And it's just hard for us to sort of catch up, and I think that's what AJ and I financially we're trying to work out. How do you pay to send 20 magazines? Like, that's what they mean when they say print is dead, like $95 to send 20 magazines that have a cover price of $5. So yeah, we're working in a weird limbo world.
It's pretty naive of us though, but that's all right.
I think that's right. I'm from a publishing background, and I started with naivety, and I think you'd never do something if you weren't a little bit naive. If you actually knew what was involved and the financial costs and the, you know, the heartache and the sweat, you wouldn't do it. But because you don't know, I think that's what excites people to do something new. And that's what excites us.
That was Annie Haswell reporting on Collect magazine in Adelaide. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're going to trot over to the New Arts Club on Dover Street to learn how and why we might be looking at a whole new online art market just after this.
Avant-garde avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we explore Sedition, a new gallery hovering about on the internet and selling digital limited edition art. Set up by Harry Blaine, founder of Haunch of Venison and Blaine Southern Galleries, this online gallery aims to be an iTunes for art. We hear from Harry and from Matt Collishaw, one of the artists commissioned to make new works that, for a few quid, might be coming to a tablet or a TV near you.
I think it has the possibility of reaching not only existing collectors, which is where I think it might start from, or I hope it might start from, but the whole point of it really is that it reaches a much wider audience who can then engage with the leading artists of our time.
I wonder whether you could tell us what you get when you go onto sedition.com and you check out the works that you might want to buy and all the rest of it. When you purchase a work, what actually happens and what do you receive?
Well, when you purchase the work, you obviously immediately become a collector of that artist, and you know, you are acknowledged as such, so you're updated about any museum shows or what might be happening in the physical world. So hopefully it acts as a bridge and a kind of information position for you as a collector. You also, of course, receive the work that you've purchased. That work goes into your own personal vault, where it's stored free of charge for you. You have your certificate of authenticity, which shows it's issued to you. It shows you what edition number you purchased, and the work. It details the work, of course, you've purchased, and that's signed by the artist and Sedition.
Talking about some of the artists you've had commissioned works for the site, Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst, Matt Collishaw, Michael Craig Martin was talking about how it allowed him to use a third dimension to his famously two-dimensional works. Are they regarding it as an experiment, or is it a new sort of new medium for them, do you think?
Many artists already have worked within this medium for some time, so to them it's a platform, if you like, which allows them to show a larger number of collectors their work and have it controlled in a way that it is the work they would like the collectors to see, rather than a poor quality image that floats around somewhere on the internet. With other work, it's less about the commission, if you like, for it. It's more about them creating things and experimenting with this area, and working with new media to develop and extend the practice that they already are familiar with, if you like.
Would you describe it as sort of entry-level collecting? I mean, what are the prices that you might be able to buy a Tracy Emin work for example, on Sedition?
I think that's one of the things that the artists have been very excited about. You can buy an original limited edition Tracy Emin for £50 at this point. You know, and whereas that's still a lot of money in certain cases, it is an accessible point to most people who'd have an iPad or a computer or somebody who might engage with this this type of work.
I have been quite intoxicated just by the ability to receive images via telephone lines, pixels. Basically, what you get is a stream, it's binary code. Those things manifest in an image, very crude, very beautiful, whatever it happened to be, and it appears and it'll disappear and reappear somewhere else on somebody else's desk at the end of a phone line. So yeah. For me, it's the perfect medium. It's got that kind of magic and almost like a spiritual quality to it.
Does that make you think differently about how you work and the sorts of images that you create?
I think it does. I mean, I think generally artists, they should be pushing grounds technically. I'm sure if, you know, the Turner was around today, would he be using oil on canvas? Not really sure that he would. Generally, artists like to be at the forefront of whatever's going on visually. What medium can we exploit? What's the best message, the biggest, brightest way of getting the message across? And for a few years, I've been working in these mediums, but it's been a bit uncomfortable because there was no real platform for them. But suddenly this whole realm has opened up where that can happen seamlessly.
I wonder whether you could tell us about your first work on the site is Whispering Weeds, and whether you could tell us about the genesis of that particular work.
Well, I was in hospital about a year ago and I kind of thought I was dying. I had three stomach ulcers that all burst. I lost half of my blood, so I was having a blood transfusion. It was touch and go for a while, and the doctors, when I looked at the doctors, they looked a little frightened, which kind of made me frightened. And I wanted something to look at, very, very antiseptic environment in the hospital. So I started looking at art, and there's one particular image which was a watercolour drawing by Albrecht Dürer from, I think, 1502, over 500 years ago. And it's just a drawing of a great tuft of weeds, which he had painstakingly drawn from the side of the road or wherever. And the fact that he put so much effort into something that's so seemingly insignificant at the time. And I was just entranced by this little image, and I thought, if I could just breathe a little bit of life into it, if these things could move, then that's what life is, this tender, small, beautiful, seemingly innocuous thing. That is life, and to lose that would be a great, great loss for me. And so I started concentrating on making a piece of work out of that.
Do you feel like you've still got kind of control over your images? Obviously, the image making is a different process, but do you still feel you've got control, or is maybe a lack of it kind of a good thing? I don't know.
I almost see it like as if you're creating music and the iPod that it's playing from is the given. That is going to be where the art's coming from. But I would hope that you can look into that. You can kind of ignore the hardware in the way. All the work can be so sympathetic that it's seamless. So you're losing control in a way, but I don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah, and I wonder whether that's, although it's possibly not the medium that it was made to be displayed on, whether sometimes it's still flattering to see one of your works as a wallpaper on someone's iPhone in a pub or on a bus or something, whether that's actually quite a nice thing that it's got such a wide distribution.
Absolutely, yeah. We just need more of them, because for many years, generally the screensaver they have is that fish tank thing, which has becoming more refined, I think. It's in HD now. You get again, like, kind of more obscure fish going on in there, but generally it's a great medium, and it's a shame if it's wasted on fish tanks.
It sounds like you're trying to give us a sneak preview of your new works.
I have done some deep sea underwater creatures, actually. Go check out Scott's restaurant. There's a work in there, video work I made in there.
That was Harry Blaine and Matt Collishaw talking about Sedition, the new online art gallery. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And now it's time for our opening night section, where we set our reporters off in the big wide world to find us the gallery openings, theatre previews and events that have got chins wagging and people chattering. Today we're off to Hong Kong, where our editor Liv Levichnik went along to the colourful artist Chili Kumari Berman's opening at the Blind Spot Gallery, where she's exhibiting photographs of the city.
Hong Kong's art scene is booming. The city's art fair is growing by the year and galleries keep opening in droves. Many are concentrated around Central, where they sit side by side with a vibrant restaurant scene, banks and shops. One of the newest is Blind Spot on Aberdeen Street. We popped by to see the opening of British-born Indian artist Chila Kumari Berman and to say hello to the gallery's owner, Mimi Gradle.
We're very new. We're still on a learning curve. But I think one of the biggest key is to have a very clear direction in how the gallery wants to position itself, what kind of art to feature, what kind of artists to represent, to carry. Blind Spot Gallery, for example, have a clear focus on contemporary photography. We feature established and as well as emerging artists, mainly from the region. So that's a very clear direction. I think we have tapped into a very niche market. In the Hong Kong market, where photography is very underrated.
Chila Kumari Berman's work is an explosion of colours, reds and pinks in an organised jumble of Hindu gods and tigers and ice lollies. She has been exhibited everywhere from the Victoria and Albert Museum in London to the Devi Foundation in New Delhi.
In this particular show, I have emphasised to the visitors why there are lolly ices and ice creams in the exhibition, And that's because my dad was an ice cream man in Liverpool. He came from India in the 1950s, and he ended up in Liverpool, and he was a tailor, and a fantastic bespoke tailor, like a fine artist, basically, you know. And he couldn't find any work, and he was sent from Dunlop in India to Dunlop in Liverpool. And so I don't think he was happy doing that kind of job. He's not that kind of 9-to-5 man. And he ended up meeting a guy in a pub who was Anglo-Indian, who introduced him to the ice cream trade.
We really like Charlotte's work because Charlotte's works have a lot of photographic elements in it, but the work itself is beyond photography. I think Charlotte shows us how an artist can work experimentally across photography, paint, print, and mixed media. And her work is all about hybrid styles and mediums, and I think that's what contemporary art really is about.
In Hong Kong, for Monocle, I'm Liv Levichnik.
That was Hong Kong editor Liv Levichnik reporting on Chilli Kumari Burman's opening at the Blind Spot Gallery in Hong Kong. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now for the minute you've been waiting for. This week it's the turn of Travis Elborough, author of The Vinyl Countdown. Before he left the studio last week, we handed him our magical portable recorder and challenged him to send us back some interesting sounds. Here's what that man came up with. My favourite bit was the cat purring. My least favourite bit was the bit at the end that sounded like The Exorcist. Anyway, that was Travis Elborough's really rather inspired 1 minute of sound. So that's just about all we've got time for this week on The Culture Show. Next week, we'll be investigating Title Music in Sydney, one of our favourite indie record shops. We'll be visiting 1.0 Music and Arts Festival on the South Bank here in London. And Alex Preston, one of the stars of this week's show, will be reading from one of his favourite books in Book Corner. Thanks very much for listening. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bill Burr. My researcher was Hannah Jenkins. And to play us out this week, we've got Truth It's Everybody, The Police. Thanks for tuning in.